and salutations. This is Tony from the Agile Revolution.
This is Craig from the Agile Revolution, and we're really lucky to here to have Uncle Bob Martin with us. Rob Martin, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
But yeah, fantastic to have you here. We're slowly working our way through the authors from Snowbird.
The Agile.
Yeah, okay.
You're definitely not the last, though. So
no, okay.
Along the way, we just keep them every time they come out to this country. I mean, you gave an awesome keynote here at the conference about the Scribe's Oath.
Yes.
And a bit about the history of computing. My first question really to you is, how did you get into computing in the first place? What was the driver for that?
My mother purchased for me a plastic computer when I was 12 years old. And this device had three flip-flops, little plastic sliders that would slide back and forth. So it could be a one or a zero. And there were little metal rods that could fit into the grooves on these flip-flops to sense their positions, and then would actuate little other metal rods that would change the state of the flip-flops. And you could block the metal rods with little tubes that you would stick onto pegs on the flip-flops. And this was a 3-bit finite state machine. And you could program it to count from 0 up to 7. Count down from 7 back to 0. It actually had a program that would support a full adder, so you could add 2 bits plus a carry and generate 2 bits plus a carry, which is tough to do with 3 bits, but they managed it. And there were a number of other little experiments you could do like this. And I was fascinated by this device, but I didn't understand it. I did all of the experiments in the book. And then I was frustrated because I had no idea why it worked. And there was a paragraph at the end of the book which said, if you want the advanced programming manual, send in a dollar and a self-addressed stamped envelope, and we'll send you the manual, which I did. It took 6 weeks because, you know, there's no Amazon in those days. And in the mail comes this little pamphlet, maybe 25 pages long, maybe. I have it now in a Ziploc bag. It's in a plastic bag, and I keep it on my bookshelf in a place of honor. But I brought it down a few years back, and I read it. And it is perhaps the most competent or cogent description of Boolean algebra written at a 12-year-old's level that I've ever seen in it. It literally was completely unapologetic. It just started with truth tables, Venn diagrams, Carnot maps, Boolean variables, associative law, distributive law, De Morgan's theorem, and then it said, okay, now you know how to manipulate Boolean equations. So, write the transition table, the bit transition table that you want your device to go through, turn that into Boolean equations, AND over OR, reduce them to lowest terms, and then use this little template to put the tubes on the pegs from the equations, which I did. I had a program in mind. It was called Mr. Patterson's Computerized Gate. And I wrote down the truth table, and I converted it into Boolean equations. I reduced the Boolean equations to lowest terms. I put the tubes on the pegs. I cycled that computer, and that little thing did exactly what I wanted it to do. And I was a programmer. That was it. I wanted that power. So that's how I got into it. Yeah. Very young age, but that would have been in 1964.
Wow. You kind of wonder if more people had to start with that kind of technology now, right? And here, I'll just go get a ruby gem from over there and that'll do that for me.
You know, the intro for a lot of people nowadays, or maybe a few years ago, was HTML. HTML and CMS, and they could actually do interesting things pretty easily by just fiddling around with a little bit of HTML. And a lot of those people have gone on to become competent programmers, surprisingly. Mm.
So I like the surprisingly bit. And so if you look at Craig and I, we're the next generation. I guess we're into the COBOL.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So we grew with the COBOL and so on.
So you were doing COBOL programming
when I first left university, yeah.
Really? Oh, gosh. I did COBOL 1969 to 1970, I was writing COBOL.
1995, graduate programmer.
Really? Really? 95, COBOL.
See, whilst I learned it at school, I then went away from it, obviously, to a different career. And then when I came back, HTML was the thing that what you're saying. We got my cogs ticking over and got me back into the
I could do this.
Industry. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. COBOL, though, I would never do again. Ever.
So
a wonderful idea that, in my estimation, failed awfully, despite the fact that so much code is written.
It was, I think it was a good it was a good idea for a business language, that and that's about as far as I can go.
Okay, I'll go with that. Just because I want to preserve.
But that was interesting. But supposedly you were supposed to give it to people to read. It's like,
oh yeah, that worked real well. Yeah. Yeah, please read my program, yeah. Mr. Businessman. Tell me if it's okay.
And as an idea, that was a good idea.
Yeah. What's this 77 mean?
Yeah. And but you said if then there, but now you're saying no anyway.
Yeah. No, never. Code has to be in this block, in this place.
Okay.
So one of the things I really liked about your talk today was talking about software as a craft.
Yes.
And I think that seems to be, that as I said to you when we were just talking pre the camera turning on, I can see that coming through. A number of other people, like Martin Fowler, quite often talks about that, came and talked about it as the cooperative game, those types of things. And why do you think it is at the moment that we've lost some of that? Because I see it a lot, is that software as a craft doesn't seem to be as big as it should be.
You mean as a cooperative, team-oriented craft?
Yes, yes.
A thing that a group of people does together by collaborating.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Did we ever have that? Have we ever embraced that fully? If you go back and look at the work that Alan Turing did, right, all the way back in 1945, right, he was pretty much a loner. He wrote that code of his in Base 32 by himself. He came up with his own way of working and his own mnemonics and his own school of thought, and then he trained other people. But he was pretty much a loner. I don't think he was heavy into collaboration. When did we really start even thinking about deep collaboration in software? That's an interesting question. I would guess that began with the IBM Federal Systems Division and the big projects they had to do, like the Polaris submarine and the jet fighters and stuff like that. And people that we now revere, people like Jerry Weinberg and John von Neumann and people like that, who began this idea of collaboration. I don't know that it went very far, though. My experience as a programmer from 1970 up to now has been primarily an experience of individual work. I spent a fair bit of time teaching programming to physics postdocs at places like SLAC, Stanford, and Brookhaven, and several other physics labs. And the one thing that's notable about physics labs is that when you ask those very intelligent people to collaborate on a project, they refuse. They will split up and they will solve the problems on their own, because the value, their own self-worth, is all about how well they can solve a problem independently. And I think some of that carries over into our domain as well. It's a problem because we, as an industry, have to learn much better collaboration skills. I don't think we're doing very well at that right now.
No, I would agree with that, because that's what we see as that's what we see as coaches, right? As agile coaches, one of our jobs is to try and help people
to get them to pair programs.
Well, not necessarily get them to pair programs.
No, we don't want them to pair.
I think pair programming is some people like it, some people don't. Some people work well with it.
Certainly. Yeah.
There's lots.
Some
of
surgeons like to wash their hands. Some surgeons don't.
Ah, there we go. So there you go. It's always one of those contentious things, Pat.
I saw him walking into it.
It was there to be had, wasn't it? Yeah. Well, you could go to the next amp and go to the mob program.
Yeah, and I did not attend Woody's talk, but I will in the next session because I want to hear that.
Yeah, that was. I was there. It was very interesting, actually. Yeah. I think one of the things that he brought through that really, really well was that if you've got everybody actually doing the mob programming together, they don't need to do the stand up and some of these other things, because if you've forgotten what you just did, then we have a bigger problem.
Yeah.
So that's really good. And the collaboration piece is actually working. But they also didn't just do that; they let them go off.
And that's always been the rule with pair programming as well. You do it when you need to. You do it to communicate. You don't have to do 100% of your code that way.
So being an agile podcast, we have to ask the question. So 2001, you went to a mountaintop and changed our lives forever. What was your space in that whole, I guess, movement before that time? Because what really happened, we've talked to Alistair Coburn and to Dave Thomas and to a few others who were there already. Well, and a lot of them were bringing things like extreme programming and Scrum and those things to the table. How did you end up sitting on the mountaintop with those 16 other illustrious people?
Drinking eggnog.
And sitting in a spa bath is what
well,
I was.
At least it wasn't Kool-Aid. So the story begins in 95, 96. At that point in my career, I'm teaching C++ to lots of people. I'm an object-oriented design consultant and a C++ expert and the editor of the C++ report. And my customers start pushing me for process. What's the process? You've taught us this design stuff. What's the process? And it became this drumbeat from customer after customer. Okay, these guys need a process. I'm going to have to figure out a process. So I spent several weeks trying to come up with a software development process, which I called CODE, C-O-D-E, and it's not even an acronym. It's a very badly formed. It was terrible. I'm not going to go through it. It was just an awful idea.
I think you should have just left it there and everyone on the floor would have gone and started Googling for it. How do I do this code? I could write a language and get stuff done.
Well, I was deeply, deeply, pessimistic about it. And then I started accidentally stumbling across Kent Beck's work. So this would have been 98 time frame. And I saw the wiki for the first time, the Ward Cunningham's wiki, and the bits on there about this extreme programming thing that Kent had only just recently named. And as I read through it, I thought, this is interesting. Maybe this is what I needed for this process that I could send to my customers. The only thing I really didn't like about it was this nonsense about writing your tests first. That was nonsense. But everything else looked pretty cool. So it just so happened that Kent Beck and I, were in Munich in late 98 or early 99. I can't remember exactly what. But we were at the OOP conference there. And I was teaching in one room, and he was teaching in the room right across from me. And we just happened to bump into each other. Hey, Kent, how are you doing? And I went over to him during a break and said, I need to talk to you about this extreme programming stuff you're doing. And he said, well, let's have lunch. So we went down to lunch, and he's explaining to me all about this stuff. And I'm getting more and more excited, thinking, there's really something to this, except for that testing nonsense. I said, I want you to write an article for the C++ report and outline all this. So this is really sacrilege, because, a C++ guy is asking this small talk heretic to write an article for the C++ report. But sure enough, he did a lovely article all about it. And I thought, okay, I got to learn more about this. So I flew out to Kent's house in Medford, near Oregon, Medford, Oregon, somewhere out there. And he and I spent 2 days. And he showed me pair programming and test-first development, as called back then, test-driven development. And the whole, I had never seen anything like this. I had never, I'd been programming for 30 years at this point. I never thought someone was going to show me this fundamentally different way to write code. But here he is, and he's pairing with me, and we're writing this silly little Java program, and I'd never seen anything like the rhythm that he was going through in this absurdly short cycle. And as we worked together, I thought, there really is something to it. Even this stupid testing thing, there's something to this. And he and I started brainstorming about teaching this and doing courses, which we did set up. We set up a whole bunch of courses in Chicago and in other places. Shortly thereafter, Kent called a meeting of a number of luminaries, and he called it the Extreme Leadership Council, or the Extreme Leadership Group. And we all went out to Medford again, and we all sat and talked with each other and thought, how are we going to promote this to the world at large? And there was quite a large contingent of people there who did not want to form a group. And it was very negative. The vote was very negative. It was like, no, we don't want to do this. Probably because they'd done it before and didn't want to do it again. Martin Fowler was there, and I was there. And I made my frustration at this relatively clear. And then as I was walking down a pathway, Martin runs after me and says, "Robert, we've got to talk." And we set up a meeting in Chicago. And so a few weeks later, we met in Chicago. And I said to Martin, what we need to do is get all these people together, the guys from Extreme Programming, guys from Scrum, guys from Feature Driven Development, all these lightweight process people. We got to get them together in some Caribbean island somewhere, and we can talk this all through. And Martin says, yeah, let's do that. And we start writing down an invitation list. And we get a whole bunch of people on this list. And then we send out an email, this massive invitation email called the Lightweight Process Summit. We did not have a location yet. Alistair, as I remember this properly, Alistair actually called me on the phone and said, "You," and he used an explicative, which starts with a B, "I was just about to send my own email out to a different group of people. We have to do this together." And he offered to recruit Jim Highsmith and he would set up something in Salt Lake. So that since we had legs on the ground, we thought, okay, let's do it in Salt Lake. Let's do it in Snowbird. And that's kind of the story. We all wound up at Snowbird. I got up and I said, hey, I think we need a manifesto. And then I sat down and everybody started talking. That was kind of the end of my contribution to that. And then the whole thing just happened. And nobody expected what has happened since.
Well, we thank you for
we do.
What is it, 16 years later, 15 years later, whatever it is?
Yeah. I've got this theory that I think that perhaps if you had done that a year earlier or 2 years earlier, it was just the right time. We'd done the world's largest waterfall project in Y2K. We had the internet to allow us to publish it. I wonder if it was a couple of years earlier whether it would have just been another one of those things in the wind.
It's hard to know. The rumblings were there earlier. The Scrum paper was published in 95. So that was Sutherland and Martine DeVoe and Mike Beadle. And I think there was a couple of other authors on that paper. I can't remember. And that actually showed up at the Patterns Conference in Illinois, the PLOP Conference, Pattern Languages of Programming. And it kind of came and then went. Just, okay, that was interesting. It was even presaged by Jim Copeland, who a couple of years before had written the Patterns of Architecture, or that's not quite the right name for that paper, but it was a groundbreaking paper because it was a bunch of patterns that outlined the behavior of successful teams. And in that paper, you can see the foreshadowing of much of what we would call agile today. But again, that paper, although it met with a lot of enthusiasm at the time, and people said, yeah, cool, it did not turn into a movement. Whatever happened at Snowbird, for whatever reason, turned into a movement, and it surprises the heck out of all of us, I think.
Yeah, we get that constant thing whenever we talk to any of the authors of Manifesto, really.
Yeah,
you had no idea it was going to get that big.
And this group of people has never met again, will never meet again, does not want to meet again.
It's like, okay.
We tolerated each other for a while, but the magic happened in that one place at one time.
It's interesting you XP played a big part because...
Big part.
And look at the gentleman across the way here. XP is how we got into this, right? Mm. And little book...
Yep.
This is how you do it, and that strange testing before you develop stuff.
Nonsense.
All right, so I'm going to bite because you've said it four times. Why is it nonsense?
Well, it's nonsense. You don't write tests first, for goodness sake. You write your code, and then you write tests. And you only write tests that you feel like writing. I couldn't grasp that until I saw it, until I understood why he was doing it. And then all of a sudden, it was this burst of illumination in my brain. Of course you would do it that way. It took me, I went home immediately after that trip to Kent's, and I started practicing test-driven development. And test-driven development is not the kind of thing you just do one day. You learn that over a period of very difficult weeks and months. So it took me a long time to get that rhythm that I had seen him employ and the skills to do this. But boy, I wouldn't go back now.
Does it frustrate you that it's still such a hard concept to teach to people 16 years or 20 years later now?
No. Mm-mm. No, it is a hard concept to teach. And it's very counterintuitive. And people don't like to be told they're doing things wrong. You know, and this, it flies right in your face. Oh, no, you should write your test first. Well, I'm not doing that. So, no, it doesn't frustrate me. It's just one of those drum beats that we have to keep on beating. The news is very encouraging. More and more people are adopting the discipline. It's becoming much more accepted. There are whole companies now that do it. I presume as that continues, they will have competitive advantages over those that don't, and we will see the turnover. But it's still probably years away.
And I guess languages now, it's default that those that your ex-unit type procedures are built in.
Yeah, well, some. I just got done doing a case study, video case study on cleancoders.com for Swift mobile developer. And yeah, there's not a lot of support there for unit testing. Yeah.
That's interesting because there's a thing called Swift Playground, I think it's called. Yeah. And my son has that at the moment. He's 13 and he's going through that at the moment. And there's not much unit testing that thing either. So it's not teaching that behavior in there. It's interesting though, very fast, very quick for him to learn.
Hmm. Yeah, okay. Good. Wait until he gets into it.
Thanks for the warning.
Yeah. Swift is one of those languages where the authors got very opinionated, decided that, okay, we've had enough of this dynamically, quasi-dynamically typed language of Objective-C. We need static, strong typing. And they really cranked it up to 11, which I'm sure is going to bite them in the rear here.
Well, it's Apple, so. I'm
usually a fan of Apple, but...
Just be careful, we published on iTunes now.
We do, and we love our overlords at Apple, thank you very much. Clean Code, that book was... that was the book I was searching for. I mean, The Pragmatic Programmer was out before it, and that was always the book I went to, but I was always striving for something, for someone to write down and go... these are the things that you should do. Make your code read like a newspaper. I remember you teaching me back in the day. And then obviously you followed with the Clean Coder book. What was the impetus for the writing of that? And have you been, surprised by the amount of uptake that actually got?
I have been surprised. Very, very pleased, obviously. It was a difficult book for me to decide to write because the fundamental decision in writing that book was to abandon a well-respected tradition of authors in computer science, which is that you do not tell people what to do. You let people make up their own mind, present the evidence, and then you back away. And in this book, I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell people what to do. I'm going to lay out some rules. And I was very clear to say, these are my rules, but they're my rules. And I just laid it out as forcefully and as objectively as I could. Or maybe subjectively is the better word. And then I published it and kind of let the chips fly. And it has turned out very well, I thought. The next book was The Clean Coder. And this is the book that, as I was writing Clean Code, I kept this backlog of stuff that I need to talk about. There's this stuff I need to talk about, but it's not about code, and I can't put it in a book named Clean Code. So this list grew and grew, and by the time I was done with Clean Code, I thought, all right, I got to write another book. And this is the book about being a professional programmer that has all the things that don't have anything to do with code. So, you know, how are you productive after having a big fight with your wife? Or your significant other, you know, how can you focus your brain? How do you do your job well if your kids are home and sick? Things like that. You know, how do you say yes to your boss? How do you say no to your boss? How do you do reasonable estimates? How do you do all these behaviors that would mark you as a professional? And so that book came out. I've been very pleased with that one as well. Mm. So
I was very interested in the talk that you just gave around the 5-year sort of changeover cycle, because that really for people like us are working in the industry a lot, and we see it come through. Keeps us in a job, but I think there really is that piece that we have to educate these guys as they come through. Do you see that a lot?
Yeah. So the premise here is that the ranks of programmers are growing at a rate of a doubling every 5 years, which means that every 5 years, there's twice as many programmers as there were the 5 years before. This keeps half the programmers in the world at less than 5 years' experience. So you and I look at this field, and maybe we've got 20 or 30 years' experience, and half the people out there have got less than five. Mm. But those are the guys doing half the work, or more than half the work. Mm. And it's like, wait a minute. There's lessons that they need to learn. How are they going to learn them? There aren't enough of us to teach the vast number of them. If you want to find a mentor who has 10 years' experience, there's one in four. Mm. You want to find somebody who's got 15 years' experience, it's one in eight. It's hard to find these guys. So that's a problem for our industry. I like to say that it keeps us in a state of perpetual inexperience, mm-hmm. the whole industry. Mm. And that's going to be difficult for us. Now, this doubling cannot continue because a few more doublings and we'll have the whole planet. So I imagine it's going to ramp down here after another couple of decades, and then we'll be able to accumulate some experience in the industry, I hope.
I wonder, though, if we started off the discussion about when you were younger and you got your little plastic computer toy, and you learned so many things in that about programming and logic, and because we've got so smart with our languages and our tooling, for someone coming in right now, it's like they've missed 27 steps in the process. And I remember watching some very smart programmers a few years ago now, trying to teach some graduates how to do test-driven development. Yeah. And I had to keep reminding them, you have to go back to the, like Kent says in his book, right, very basic. And they went, but we can charge passes. I went, but these guys don't understand why you're skipping 27 steps.
Yes.
And I wonder whether that's part of our problem here.
Certainly it's part of our problem. There's a whole ranks of programmers who are cut-paste programmers. They really don't know how to write code, but they can copy from here and copy from there and do a little glue.
So it's like
And that's it's another problem. I recently put a video on cleancoders.com, which is called Programming 101. And this is a free video, and it teaches the beginnings of programming from the assumption that you know nothing. And it tries to address this problem you're talking about, because it assumes you know nothing at all, and it begins to address what a computer is and how to program it in the simplest possible terms. So the model I use is a light switch. And a light switch is an interesting device. It has memory, it's got an input, it's got an output, a little processing, not much processing, but some. And I actually show, as we're analyzing the behavior of the light switch, I put in a little tiny bit of code, a tiny little bit of code that shows what the logical relationship is. And then it turns out that there's another light switch in my basement that controls the same lights. And they're separated physically. So if you flip one, the lights turn on. And if you flip the next one, the lights turn off. And it doesn't matter what position these switches are in. I mean, it's just if you flip one, the lights will change state. And okay, well, that's interesting. And we discuss that. And then there's a little bit more code showing an exclusive OR operation. Okay, fine. Very little bit of code, just basic Boolean algebra. And in the midst of this, I go through the truth tables of AND and OR and De Morgan's theorem and stuff like that. And it turns out in my basement there's a third switch that controls the same lights. Okay, so now we have to add that logical condition in, and big truth table now, and lots of conditions, and maybe there's some way to boil it down. Turns out there's a fourth switch in my basement that controls the same lights, so we have to go through this whole thing again. And now you've got the situation, you got a light switch over there and a light switch over there. Two people could hit it at the same time. And if they hit it at the same time, the lights would not change state. And this is wrong. This is wrong behavior. So then we have to correct that behavior in the code. Now we have to bring the human element in. People are going to react oddly to it. So in the span of about 90 minutes, I try to cover the basics of what computers are and some of the problems and what a program is, and then some of the problems that a programmer can run into in even something as simple as a bunch of light switches.
Wow.
It's a hell of a basement,
though. Yeah, I was going to say, you got a huge basement.
Yeah, it's just when there's stairs over here, and there's a bedroom over there, and there's two offices over here, and there's four switches, yeah.
You did an experiment today.
I did, yes.
So, women in programming.
Women in programming, yes.
Yeah, so you were very ported, obviously,
yes,
what you were trying to get across.
Mm-hmm.
How do we fix that? How do we improve that? How do we get women? So we talk about this sort of a bit on the podcast because the missing member of our podcast, Renee, is obviously of the other gender, and we talk about women in technology and even women in agile coaching and how we can and what we can do to help them join. I know it's a big question.
Computer science problem.
It is a fascinating problem to me, and it's also a significant problem. It's significant because if we're doubling every 5 years, we're ignoring half the population, and that's clearly unstable. As to why this has happened, I don't have any reasonable or provable idea. My hypothesis differs from others. Some people have said that the reason this happened is because in the early 80s, when personal computers came out, they were marketed towards boys, toys for boys. And if a father bought a computer, he would give his son more access to it than his daughter. I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe it is, maybe it's not, but leave that as alone. I think something else happened. In the early days of software, it was considered women's work. It was clerical in nature. The men built the hardware. So Alan Turing worked on the hardware, you know, and all these guys worked on the hardware. And they had lots of women, because there weren't any men, they were off fighting the war, actually doing the operating of the machine and coding the codes and so on. When they built the ENIAC, the electronic computer, Princeton? The men built the computer. They were walking in and out of the halls with vacuum tubes everywhere and soldering stuff and doing manly kinds of things. And it was up to the women to do the programming. It was really interesting, detailed programming work, these funny patch cables with timing marks. And they really had to know what they were doing, but it was a staff of women. And this is a very old tradition. Astronomers started recruiting women before the turn of the last century. And they would have the women come in and do the studies of the photographs taken by the men, but they were not allowed to touch the telescopes. The men touched the telescopes. The men touched the hardware. The women would use, you know, little magnifying glasses, and they would study. And some of these women came up with the most startling of discoveries. Lots of these women, like Annie Jump Cannon and Henrietta Leavitt, discovered the relationship between variable stars and distance, the whole classification of stars, the color classification, the spectral class of stars, was discovered and elaborated by these women. And they were paid nothing. They were recruited and paid nothing because they were women. This attitude moved into the 20th century. It moved in through the 30s and into the 40s, into the 50s. And then at some point, somebody realized there's money to be made if you're a programmer. There's power. There's political power if you're a programmer. And the boys deluged into the field. And the women left. And it's a startling curve. You look at the curve of the population of women in programming, and it just falls off a cliff. So that's my theory. I don't know if it's correct or not, but that's my particular hypothesis. What do we do about it? Well, girls, come on. We need the difference in perspective and outlook. I had a fascinating discussion with a woman programmer about 5 years ago. I was sitting at a bar, And she asked me, what's programming like for you? And I said, you know, when I get a program to work, I feel like the hunter bringing home meat. I have killed the beast. I am successful. And she looked at me and she said, well, I feel like I have nurtured something into being. I mean, it's very feminine, and I hate to be, you know, stereotypical about that, but that's two very, very stereotypical results. But I think we need both of them. I think you need people bringing home the meat and spearing the beast and killing problems. I think you need the idea of nurturing. I think the female attitude is one that we don't have. So you look around at these, and I'll use the word idiot startup companies, who are our testosterone factors, right? We're going to hire as many 21-year-old programmers who are going to sacrifice absolutely everything to stab beasts and bring home meat, to work 80 hours a day for virtually no reward, and we're going to get to market first that way. I think that's suicide. Most of those companies fail horribly, but that's the attitude. What would a startup company of mostly women be like? What attitude would they have? How would they approach the problem of you know, bringing a new product to market? My guess is that they would have a different kind of approach and a different kind of success. A different kind of success.
Okay.
You notice we didn't go any further.
It's three men talking about why women aren't in the field, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I was trying to peddle this out of there. I do want to go back to software craftsmanship just briefly. One of the things we often talk about in this podcast is where to next. I get the feeling that that over the last 15 years, I feel things have improved. We've gone in the direction that you aspired to 16 years ago when you helped do that. But you moved out of the agile field and more into the craftsmanship side. How are we doing on that? And what do we need to do to get that word out and get people to sign up?
Kill the beast.
Or nurture it.
So have I moved out of the agile space? I am no longer an active... proponent is not the wrong word. Even participant is not the right word. But I do not actively push the agile thing. There's enough people doing that. And something else happened to agile 2005, 6, 7, in that range, where the I call it the invasion of the project managers. The project, because the certified Scrum thing was just so successful, and everybody had to be a certified Scrum Master. All the project managers have to have this in their PMBOK now. So this project manager moved in, and all the programmers moved out. If you go to an Agile conference now, you won't find an awful lot of technical discussions, mostly about the people problems and the project management problems and the leanness and the Kanban that and the whatever this. And you know, the interesting technical things are getting shoved to the side. I'm very glad that there's plenty of technical stuff here at Yale. It's been a very pleasant surprise. As a response to that, the programming community said, hey, we've been left out in the cold. These guys have kind of kicked us out of the house that we built. We need to build another house. And so the craftsmanship movement began as a kind of reaction, with the hope that we could reunify, bring the two camps back together. Kent Beck said something fascinating at Snowbird. He said, the goal of extreme programming, and I'll extend that to all of Agile, the goal of Agile was to heal the divide between technology and business, between programming and business. And the exact opposite has happened. Right? The agile community has focused entirely on the project management and business side, and the technology people feel like they've been left out. And so now we have two camps, the craftsmanship camp and the agile camp, and I don't see them moving together yet. I hope they do. There has been some work towards that reunification in the Agile community, but unfortunately it's not enough, I don't think. What's coming? Well, that's a really interesting question. Is there anything coming? Do we need the next big thing? We have, as an industry, we have been in this cycle punctuated by the next big thing, next big framework, next big language, next big process, next big thing. And a whole culture of consultants has risen up around this churning wheel. Do we need this wheel to keep churning? Is there something new coming? For example, new languages. What new language has anything new in it? And the answer to that is there hasn't been anything new in languages probably for 20 or 30 years. We see a lot of the same old ideas getting churned around and churned around and churned around, but is there anything new in any of that? Have we seen anything new in the process space? And we see, okay, Agile was new. Well, it actually wasn't very new. It was this very old idea, but it got reintroduced. Okay. Kanban new? Is Lean new? Man, it's old stuff getting cycled around and around again. Do we need the next big thing? Or will we be like different industries where they've stopped that wheel from churning and have begun to mature? I'm kind of in the maturing camp. Mm. I'm thinking, okay, maybe it's time for the wheel to stop turning. Maybe we ought to unify our languages, unify our approaches, actually become a profession that knows what they're doing, has a language or a set of language, has a set of frameworks, has a set of processes without constantly having to churn any longer. I could be wrong.
So how do we bring the software craftsmanship and agile communities together? Is there, because it does concern me, and to be open in this podcast, I'm about to join the Agile Alliance board from 2017 yeah. onwards, and that was one of the things that so that's near and dear to my heart.
So the upshot of my keynote here was that we need a set of ethics and standards that define a profession. And it seems to me that the Agile community, and maybe that means the Agile Alliance, I'm not sure, but it seems to me that the Agile community and the craftsmanship communities, if they could unify, are the right communities to establish that set of ethics. I don't think any of the older ones are, the IEEE and the ACM. I think they've gone way too academic. And what we need are practitioners who are in the trenches, the agile ones, the craftsmanship ones, who sit down and work together with each other and come up with a set of standards and a set of ethics that they can then credibly apply to the entire industry.
And go look at those that you presented in the keynote today as a good starting point for conversation.
Yeah, I call that the programmer's oath. It's on my blog site. It's easy to read. It's a suggestion for a beginning conversation about ethics and standards.
Well, it's been a fantastic to sit down and get to talk to you one-on-one, Uncle Bob.
Thank you.
I know there's lots of things you do, and you are wearing the clean coat shirt. So,
coders.
if people want to know more about you and more about the stuff you're doing, including that, where do they go?
They go to cleancoders.com. That's where our videos are. And cleancoder.com, that's my personal website. And they can learn all they want to about what I do and what our videos are about.
Mm-hmm. And go check out the books, obviously. There's a whole pile.
There's a few books. Yeah, there's a couple of good books there. I'd say go and read those. There's still as valid as ever could be, along with take XP Kent's book as well and read that too.
Oh, Extreme Programming, Embrace Change.
Embrace
Change. That's a wonderful book, especially the first edition.
The white book, yes.
The white book.
I'm all for the white book.
And, good book. Yeah.
I guess one thing we always do at the end of our podcast is with the Agile Revolution, we like to sign off and say "Viva la Revolution!" So, to join us as we sign off.
Sure, because we started a revolution.
Yeah, that's it. So so thanks for your time, and on that note,
Viva la Revolution.
Thank you.